Session number 9173, Reel 1.
John Medaway, tape 1. Could I ask you first of all, Mr. Medaway, about your background? Where were you born and brought up?
I was born here in London and brought up here. My father was a chartered accountant working in the city, and I went to local school and then to the county high school in Ilford, and got a scholarship from there to Reading University, where I read classics. I'd done Latin at school, and it was on the basis of my Latin, I think, that they they took me, but it meant learning Greek during the long vacation before I went up. So I worked pretty hard at my Greek then, and found I could hold my own when I got to university with people who'd been learning Greek a great deal longer than I. My tutor there was a delightful old man, Percy Ure, who was a great expert on the Byzantine age and on pottery and so on. And after I'd taken my my degree, they were kind enough to give me a first in classics. I had thought of becoming an archaeologist, but then the way young men's minds switch, I suddenly thought that to go overseas would be interesting, and applied to the Colonial Office and went along for interviews. Recruitment in those days was entirely, for the Colonial Service, was entirely by interview. Not by examination, and after I'd been there four or five times, I did a little postgraduate work in at university on Platonic philosophy and so on, went to the Colonial Office, and there I didn't realize the significance at the time, but there was Hugh Foote, a young district officer from Palestine who'd been seconded for a period of service to the Colonial Office and was working in their recruitment department. I think the Arabs had put him on their hit list at some stage, and so it had been thought a good thing for him to go and have a spell in the Colonial Office, and we got on very well together. I presume he recommended me for recruitment into the service. I've pulled his leg since then about the great mistake he made, but anyway, I was offered appointment. During the conversations I'd had there, it was all the time how much I would like to go to Cyprus and how reasonable that would be in view of my Greek, I suppose. I had begun learning modern Greek at that time also. But surprise, surprise, when the offer of appointment came, it was to Malaya. So I started the year's preparatory course in London, went to the London School of Oriental Studies, and began learning Malay there, which I very much enjoyed. But after a couple of months, suddenly a vacancy turned up in Cyprus and they offered it to me, and so I went there.
What date would that have been when you first went to Cyprus?
I think it was 37, something, I think is what I remember. Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me about your work in Cyprus, you know, before the emergency period?
Yes, well, one started as what was called an administrative cadet with the princely salary of, I think it was £30 a month, which was very good pay in those days. I lived like a prince, sharing a house, an old Turkish house in the middle of Nicosia with another young administrative officer, and we really lived very well. One was given the usual sort of junior jobs to do in the secretariat to begin with. I was put in charge of the passport office, so I became an authority on British nationality and passport work and so on. And then after a bit was moved on to different jobs in the secretariat, and then to the Nicosia district office as assistant district commissioner. The government was organised really with the usual colonial type of government, with a central secretariat and then district administration in offices in each of the districts with a commissioner. And, of course, the technical departments, education, health, public works and so on, who all had their separate district officers or superintendents in the districts. The job of the commissioner was to coordinate the work of the of all the departments working there, although he didn't have any direct, obviously, any direct responsibility for what the doctors or the engineers were doing. So in Nicosia, I worked as assistant district commissioner there for 2 or 3 years, and that was really fascinating work when I look back on my time. It's very clear to me that the happiest days I spent were as a district officer in different districts in Cyprus. Then I think I was back to the secretariat or various wartime jobs, and then for 2 years I was out with the Cyprus Volunteer Force, pretending to be a soldier. I wasn't. that was at the time just before Crete and then afterwards, when everybody thought that Cyprus was perhaps next on the list. But then in Baghdad, the British, if you remember, managed to get control, and we'd all been expecting another Crete, really, with an invasion, but it didn't happen. We had a few air attacks, mostly by Italian aircraft and so on, but otherwise it was not a very eventful war in Cyprus.
What were you able to do to prepare for that expected invasion? What were the forces on Cyprus at the time, apart from the group you have described?
Well, of course, in the early days, there were very few. The normal garrison of Cyprus pre-war was only, I think, a company of British troops. But, of course, they brought in quite a considerable number of troops there, and Cyprus began to come into its own during the war as a place d'armes, as Disraeli had termed it, I think, a sort of operational base. But there weren't all that number of troops there because, of course, they were being deployed elsewhere. The preparations they varied a great deal according to the general in charge. The military mind is like that. Each one had his own solution to the problem. So I think we began with a Marine general who thought the thing to do was to fight them on the beaches, and so a lot of concrete forts and pillboxes and so on were constructed around the beaches. Then the next man, I think, had some air experience and said, oh no, they're going to land with aircraft and gliders, and the whole of Cyprus is open to them. All this large, extensive central plain is ideal landing ground. So what we must do is build obstacles. Fortunately, there were a lot of labour, and so they turned the villagers on to building little hillocks all over the place, which you can still see signs of in Cyprus. Well, the next one was a cavalry general, and he said, no, no, this is all wrong. We'll build what I think he called hedgehogs in the foothills, and then we'll charge out and destroy the enemy when they land, or, of course, in the air. And so it went on. But in fact, thank God, Cyprus was spared.
Would you have been working with Hugh Foote again during this period?
Not at that period. He came back... No, he came to Cyprus for the first time after serving, I think, in Tunisia in the sort of wartime administration there. And then just after the war, he came... or at the end of the war, he came to Cyprus as colonial secretary, and I did work very closely with him then. I was in the secretariat and was the secretary of the governor's executive council, which was interesting because you didn't raise your voice, but you sat at the end of the table and made as coherent a record as you could of the discussions. The Executive Council was the advisory body which the governor consulted, but it did have a good deal of power. No governor would ignore their advice. There were three, I think, Greek Cypriots and one Turkish Cypriot on the council, and then the colonial secretary and one of the senior district commissioners. That was a fascinating work, and of course one did get an insight into the whole range of government activity. Then I was also put on at that time to work on the preparation of development plan. That was something that Hugh Foote was very keen on. At that time, the Colonial Development and Welfare Act had been brought in, and so there was money available for capital investment, which hadn't been before. Cyprus had had to live more or less on its own revenues, and so there hadn't been a great deal of money available for development work, though I think the administration had done fairly well with the money available. Then they brought originally a very distinguished Indian civil or former Indian civil servant, Sir Douglas Harris. He was an irrigation engineer, I think. And he was put in charge of the preparation of the development, the five-year development program, and I was assisting him. Then after he'd got it started, he left, and I was asked to continue and complete the preparation of the development report. That again was fascinating work because once more you had to study the activities, the plans and hopes of all the different departments of the government. And the plan as it emerged, I think, was pretty good for the times. It looks all rather small beer in comparison with the really marvellous improvements that have been effected in Cyprus since independence. They really have, as you know, they've done remarkably well there, and the island, in spite of its political tribulations, has prospered in the most remarkable way. So I completed the work on the development program. Hugh Foote was kind enough to allow me to work in my spare time as District Commissioner Kyrene. So I used to spend my weekends running the district there, and then the week in Nicosia in the Secretariat working on the development program, an ideal life.
I expect you were getting to know the Greek and Turkish Cypriots quite well during this period, were you not?
Oh, yes. Well, that was, of course, a feature of life in Cyprus. They're charming, engaging, entertaining people, both the Greeks and the Turks. And one had to work very closely with them, and indeed it was a joy to do so. There were, after all, only, I think, 120 British expatriate officers there, and the civil service was something of the order of 5,000 or 6,000 people, and many of them extremely capable, many of the Greeks, the Greek and Turkish Cypriots, extremely capable people, and it would be very foolish not to work closely with them and to take their views and suggestions and advice very carefully into consideration. Really, from the beginning, I'd found it very easy and very pleasurable to get on with the with my Cypriot colleagues and form friendships and with them. I think when one looks back on it, people tend to forget really how much work the how much fine work the Cypriot servants of the British colonial government did for the sake of their own country and their fellow Cypriots. It really was a remarkably good job. In the districts, of course, most of the staff were the doctors and the engineers and the foresters were Cypriots, and so one was closely in touch with them. And then, of course, there were the friendships one formed with people outside the service. I was fortunate enough to acquire a very wide circle of friends quite quickly. And then, at just about that time, just after the war, I married my dear wife, who was a Greek Cypriot, and so that extended further my circle of friends.
How much say did the Greek and Turkish Cypriots have in the government legislation? You know, were they represented in government at all?
At this time, there had been a legislative council up to the time of the Ennassus riots in 1930. But it had not been a very effective body. It was really it was difficult to work because of the once again of the political disagreement between Greeks and Turks. So a lot of the time was spent in frustrating discussion there. The nominated officials and the Turkish members together just outnumbered the Greek Cypriot members, and so that gave rise to a lot of friction. I never knew, of course, how that body. I had no personal knowledge of how that body worked, but Sir Ronald Storrs, in his book Orientations, the governor used to have to take the chair at the Legislative Council meetings, and he wrote that it was humiliating and a waste of time. It didn't seem apparently work at all well. Well, coming back to the period when I was there, the Greek and Turkish Cypriot members of the Governor's Executive Council were powerful men. Their role was simply advisory, but the advice they gave was very, very carefully taken into account and given great importance. And they were all outstanding men. With a very high reputation within their own communities, people like Sir Panayoti Kakoyannis, a lawyer in Limassol, Sir Paul Pavlidis, businessman, Yanni Kleridis, who was the father of Glafkos Clarice, and a very distinguished lawyer, the man who in the first elections for president stood against Archbishop Macarius. He was a very fine man. And then on the Turkish side, there was Sir Mehmet Munir, who's been the director of EFKAF, and then a Turkish judge, Halit Bey, and so on. They really were extremely capable men. And on the whole, I would have said they represented very effectively the views and wishes of the mass of the people. Of course, not the not the views of the leadership, particularly on the Greek side, because of course by agreeing to serve on the governor's executive council, they were really running counter to the policy of the ethnarchy, which was that Ennesis was the only subject to be discussed, and there shouldn't be any participation in the work of the colonial government.
How far did that go back, the sort of demand for Ennesis, so far as the ethnarchy was concerned, in your experience of Cyprus? You know, when you first went to Cyprus in the 30s, were they demanding that then?
Oh, indeed, yes. Yes, it had always been there, and indeed I suppose it dates back at least to 1821, to the Greek War of Independence. They had always looked forward to becoming, the Greek Cypriots, to becoming a part of Greece, and they regarded themselves as part of the Hellenic nation. And irredentism was, of course, a very marked feature of Greek policy in the 19th century. They developed the megali there, the grand idea, which was that Greece one day should reacquire all the all the lands which had been Greek in antiquity, and in particular Constantinople. It was, I suppose, not a very practical idea, but it appealed to Greek national sentiment. So in Cyprus, the Greek Cypriots welcomed the British when they arrived in 1878, but almost immediately said, we are looking forward to attaining our national aim as a result of the presence of the British here. As it gradually appeared that the British were not going to hand over the island to Greece, as they had done in the case of the Ionian Islands when we were short for a brief period in control there, the campaign for Ennesis developed and began to take a very marked anti-British tone.
How did the Turks react to that, the Turkish Cypriots?
Well, when the British came, of course, it had been Ottoman territory, and their reaction to the coming of the British was not hostile, but it was lukewarm. A fair number of Turks, I believe, at that time, particularly the richer Turks, did depart from Cyprus and go and settle in the mainland. But on the whole, the Turks accepted a British rule, and in particular, they accepted it as a protection against the Greek pretensions for union with Greece. They were utterly opposed to that. The old antipathy which existed between Greek and Turk, of course, was also present in Cyprus, and there had been a good deal of conflict during the Ottoman period between the two communities.
So the Turks always feared that one day they might be forced against their will into union with Greece, and naturally enough, Cyprus was their homeland as well as that of the Greeks, and they didn't see why, simply because the Greeks were in the majority, they should have the right to dispose of the Turkish Cypriot homeland against their wishes, and that, of course, was the root of the whole problem.
Do you feel that there was British sympathy for the Greek desire, the Greek Cypriot desire for Enosis?
Without doubt, hardly had the Disraeli pulled off his coup and occupied the island, then of course Phil Hellenes in London began questioning the wisdom of the whole her venture, and and appealing to British opinion for a sympathy towards the Greeks, the very natural Greek Cypriot demand for union with Greece.
Do you think if the Turks hadn't been in Cyprus, that would have been granted?
Yes, I believe there's no doubt whatsoever that if it hadn't been for the Turkish factor, not merely, I would say, the presence of the Turkish Cypriots in Cyprus, but also the Turkish interest from mainland Turkey in the defence of the southern coast of Turkey. Cyprus seemed to them extremely important, and no doubt it was. But if it hadn't been for the Turkish factor in the Cyprus problem, I myself have little doubt that Britain would have been disposed to hand over to the island to Greece, and perhaps under certain terms of British bases, perhaps even some form of Turkish protection for the Turkish Cypriots. But in principle, yes, I've no doubt whatsoever that would have happened long ago. It's significant to my mind that the only time that Britain ever made a serious offer to hand over Cyprus to Greece was in the First World War, when Turkey had allied itself with the Central Powers. Then in 1915, I think it was, the British government offered Cyprus to Greece on condition that they came into the war on the side of the Allies. The then government in Greece was pro-German and turned the offer down. So that was a curious episode, because it's often quoted, has often been quoted since, as evidence that the British really conceded in their hearts the case for Enosis. And on the other hand, it has been used to prove that the Greeks had their chance and failed to take it up.